This is session number 3, major construction contract model. So if you didn't want to listen to that, then now's your time to run out. Okay? That was my one joke. I've got 2 jokes that I got to say. This is going to be a 3D presentation. But don't look for your glasses. I've got Doug, and Diego. 3. That's the end of my jokes. Hadn't noticed that until a few minutes ago, so I figured I might as well share. Department has been working on developing projects in through the years. As part of the restructuring of the UTP, we started trying to develop these major projects. Some of these are major reconstructions like the Katy Freeway. And we've gone through the years and have developed contracts that were developed through our traditional design bid build process. We also have developed major corridors using our design build model for toll roads. And of course, we're fixing to start using a third model, which is the design bid build concession type model, where we have a developer that's going to not only finance the plan, design, build the project, but then maintain it and operate it for a 50-year period. We thought that it would be a good opportunity to allow the people that are developing these projects to make a presentation and let us know how they go about to develop these projects and how they would implement these projects, tell us about what works, what doesn't work, and whatever else they want to tell us. So we have 3 great speakers today. Like I said, I've got 3Ds, and Tom still looking for his glasses. But our first speaker is Doug Pickock, who's the owner and chairman and chief executive officer of Williams Brothers Construction Company out of Houston and in other areas, but their office is in Houston. And Doug holds a degree in civil engineering. Mr. Pickock has been a prominent transportation leader for over 40 years. He served as chairman of the Houston Chamber of Commerce Transportation Committee and was twice president of the Texas Highway Branch of the Association of General Contractors. Doug was inducted into the Texas Good Roads Transportation Association's Hall of Fame and was recently honored by the Greater Houston Chapter of the Texas Society of Professional Engineers as Engineer of the Year. Doug's going to give us a presentation on a major project that we're developing in Houston, the reconstruction of the Katy Freeway. As I mentioned, this project is a project that's being developed under a design bid build model. That was done through designed by the department through consultants. We had a general engineering consultant that was managing the coordination of all the projects. He has the luxury of building several of the Katy Freeway projects, but also has to coordinate some work with other contractors that are building adjacent to him. So with that, I'll turn the program over to Doug and let him make his portion of the presentation. The way we'll do this is we're going to make all 3 presentations, and then we will go ahead and have a little question and answer session. And as Mr. Barron said this morning, and in my session I've added we had another item in there for me to speak. I just never put it on the program. I'm going to talk a little bit about Senate Bill 792 and what we're doing on moving forward with some of the techniques that were put in place under 792 to develop projects. But we'll add that part of the presentation will be the last thing we do, and then we'll have a final Q&A. So with no further ado, we'll go ahead and pass it on, Mr. Pickle.
I'm going to let Bob Lanham. Thank you, Amadeo. If y'all don't mind, I think I'll just do it from here. Design, bid, build has been declared dead, outmoded, out of date, barely kicking. And since a lot of people say the same thing about me, it was kind of appropriate that I be the one. But I want to tell you, both me and design, bid, build are alive and well. Katy Freeway Project, which we're going to talk about here for a few minutes, nothing like it has ever been done. I hope that something like it will be done in the future. I hope NTTA does the same thing with 121. I don't know what they're going to do, but it is really a unique project. And the mastermind was Gary Treach, and the people that were directly involved, and this is dangerous to do names, but Delvin Dennis, Deputy District Engineer, Charles Gaskin, District Construction Engineer. The 2 area engineers were Clifford Halverson, who each had about $700 million worth of work on the Katy Freeway. And last but not least, a PB, Parsons Brinkelhoff, David Milner, played a big role. And a lot of these slides that I'm going to show were actually stolen from Parsons Brinkelhoff and TxDOT. I want to talk about what the Katy Freeway project is very briefly, what's unique about it, I want to talk about the construction of it and then what's unique about the construction of it. It's 25 miles west of Houston from I-610 to the town of Katy, Texas. It crosses three major highways, Beltway 8, Highway 6, and SH-99. There's a typical look at the freeway as it existed prior to construction. You might notice the green strip on the left-hand side. That's the old Southern Pacific Railroad right-of-way, and it really was a blessing to make this job work because it gave us somewhere to start without traffic on it. This is a quick picture of I-10 at Fry Road on the left before construction and on the right after construction was completed. The next slide is the I-10-610 interchange. If you look in the lower right-hand corner, you see a couple of little black, two little black squares. I don't know why I bring this up except it about killed this building. There's actually a silver tunnel. There's a tunnel taking a frontage road up into I-10. It's very hard to see there, but it was pretty unique. The next slide was one of the two major interchanges. This one's I-10 at Beltway 8, before on the left, after on the right. And what was done in the reconstruction was take it from an existing 11 lanes to 18 lanes. And one of the unique features was the two managed toll lanes in the middle. The reconstruction was for 25 miles of the freeway under traffic, plus an additional 2 miles north and south on Interstate 610. There were two freeway-to-freeway interchanges, 27 grade separations, total projected construction costs, these are revised to be actual, of $1.45 billion, one of the largest highway construction projects in the state history. First project in the nation to construct toll lanes on an existing interstate highway, and they did it in 9 major contracts. The total project program cost was $2.54 billion, $1.45 for construction, $705 million for right-of-way acquisition and utility relocation, and the remaining for design and program management of $378 million. There were several things that were really unique about the project. Mentioned it's roughly $1.5 billion worth of construction work. It had $250 to $260 million interchange projects, one of which was the largest that had ever been let. It used the major investment study process. It was a corridor-wide program, not individual project. Used a general engineering consultant, which was Parsons Brinckelhoff, and they did a really fine job helping TxDOT with it. It was fast-tracked in the best sense of the word. While some projects were being designed, other projects were being built. And then the right-of-way acquisition activities were on an outsourced basis. The program schedule shows that the design started in 2001. Construction, first contract was let in May of 2003. Construction started in the middle of 2003. It's scheduled to complete on this slide in 2009. It's actually going to be complete in 2008, and our target really is to complete it in July of 2008, about a year from now. It's 80% federal funds, 20% state and local. TxDOT and Harris County operate the variable price toll lanes, and the initial funding plan was approved by FHWA in 2003. The program design partners were the TxDOT Houston District, which included the general engineering consultant of Parsons Brinckelhoff, 9 sub-consultants, 10 section design consultants, and 30 sub-consultants. And the entities involved are the Harris County Toll Road Authority, Flood Control, Harris County Public Infrastructure Department, Precinct 3, City of Houston, Metro, Corps of Engineers, all helped TxDOT. Quite a right-of-way and utility acquisition program. 442 parcels of right-of-way to obtain, 910 relocations, more than 35 different utility agreements, utility companies, and 130 separate utility agreements. Hired a right-of-way acquisition consultant, 2-year, $10 million contract, and the GEC coordinated all the utility relocations. One of the unique features of the construction of the project was the fact that, if you remember the first slide, I'm ad-libbing, Bobby. If you remember the first slide, we had that open right-of-way there. But to get this job going, the normal procedure of building and reconstructing a freeway would be to kind of do the frontage roads first, relieve the traffic a little bit, and then do the main lanes. The fast-track feature of this job was that we built the main lanes first before they even bought the right-of-way for the frontage roads. And until the right-of-way for the frontage roads was bought, the utilities couldn't be relocated. So during all this time period where you're buying right-of-way and trying to get utility contracts under construction, we're blowing and going out there building the main lanes. There were 9 major construction contracts, 7 under construction totaling $1.15 million. 2 contracts are complete, $292 million. All major contracts will meet the anticipated substantial completion date of December of 2008. All construction is on schedule with certain critical steps ahead of schedule, and I already mentioned the funding. The status is 6 of these contracts were awarded to Williams Brothers. I think we had about $1.25 billion worth of work. 3 were awarded to Balfour Beatty, and I think they had about $200 million worth of work. All the contractors are on target with many milestones ahead of schedule. And one of the really unique features of the project, which provided for the fast-track construction, was $61 million, roughly 5% of the contract cost in incentive payments. And what that does, and if you want to do a fast-track job, any of you other contracting entities, I can't overemphasize the need for this, because to do this work, $1.5 billion in 5 years, and I don't know where it's been done that quickly on a highway ever. I know it hadn't been in Texas. I doubt if it's been done that quickly anywhere. But one of the keys is we have to go to a 24/7 operation, which is fairly unique. It's unique in Texas highway work anyway. When you do that, you get a lot of labor inefficiencies and lack of productivity at night that you get in the daytime. And what happens with the incentive payments is it gives you the money that you didn't have in the bid for all this helter-skelter work. It gives you a reimbursement of those extra costs to work 24/7. As a matter of fact, in our company, we don't call them incentive payments or bonuses. We call them cost reimbursements, because that's what they do. But they're vital to get you a 24/7 project done, in my opinion. The next slide shows the contracts that were let. One for 84, one for 208, one for 153, one for 84, one for 250, 204, 158, 263, and 43. And the anticipated completion dates of those contracts vary from July of 06 to June of 08. That's what our target is. Utility relocation was really an awesome. It's still going on. It's still a terrible problem. There was $311 million worth of utility relocation, 24 miles of various sizes of pipe to be relocated. And the traffic during construction, another unique, Jody Giles out there, he'll tell you, this is the only highway job we worked on, and we've been doing this a long, long time. But all you hear in Houston, and it's a real 180 switch, is traffic flows better on the Katy Freeway under construction than it flowed before construction started. And ladies and gentlemen, it's a true statement. It does flow, and the credit is all due to TxDOT. The traffic control plan that they came up with is unbelievable, and it's just awesome the way the traffic flows during construction. Again, I mentioned the incentives and disincentives with the interim milestones, major milestones, and project conclusion milestones. One of the other ingenious things Treach did, is he here? He got really wise on the last 3 major contracts, and he put a $2.5 million bonus on each last 3 contracts to complete by a date certain, which was July next year. And the mantra on our jobs right now is tomorrow is worth $2.5 million. Because if you miss that by one day, you don't get the $2.5 million. And what it did, it put the contractor in a position of buying in to address the right-of-way and utility problems, at least from an interest standpoint, instead of saying, that's in my way, give me more time, give me more money. I mean, we get in there and we raise as much hell as we can with everybody to get the right-of-way going and get the utilities removed. It was an ingenious idea. There are liquidated damages from $5,000 to $75,000 a day, and those incentive payments range from $3 to $12 million in each contract. A few quick construction photos. I-10 westbound main lanes at Kirkwood, northbound main lanes at Woodway, southbound main lanes at Memorial. Can't read the next one. And then I'd like to close by talking about the uniqueness of the construction. I mentioned the traffic control plan and the fact that you built the main lanes first while the right-of-way was still being bought and utility contracts were still being let by the utility companies instead of the normal way of building the frontage road first. That was really a big deal that I can't overemphasize. And again, kudos on the traffic control plan. It's unbelievable the good press we're getting. Last Friday night, we had to close I-10 at Beltway 8, and we told them we were going to open it up Monday morning. We got it opened up in the middle of the night, actually Saturday night, and Channel 26 went out Friday night and started interviewing people around there to see how upset they were about the freeway being closed. I didn't see this, but what it was told to me was that the people said, we ain't got a problem. As fast as that work's going and as hard as those people are working and out there in the rain, we haven't got a problem. And then we got it open a day early, and I heard that Monday morning ABC TV did a program on praising the contractor. They never use our name, unfortunately, but praising the contractor for getting it open in one day instead of 2 days. I mentioned the incentive and the $2.5 million date certain. One of the things that's really important to get this done is it takes two people. It can't just be the contractor. It doesn't work. If the contractor is committed to fast construction and the state's not, it's the sound of one hand clapping. It doesn't work. It takes both. The job has to get priority by the state. All the other state projects have to take second place. The hot job has to get priority. And one of the things that really worked for us were job site decisions. We literally had somebody told me I shouldn't say this, but a time or two we had sketches made on the job by a PE and a seal put on the sketch to keep it from slowing it down. Again, the projects have to have preferential treatment from TxDOT. And I would conclude to say that the coup de grace for design, bid, build construction is this is a $1.5 billion job performed in approximately 5 years, which is a rate of $300 million a year or $25 million worth of work a month on 25 miles of freeway. We did about 85% of that. Balfour Beatty did 15%. Again, I don't know. I'm not aware of anywhere that's ever been done. I hope it gets done again. Design, bid, build is alive and well. It does work. And Acadie Freeway is a showcase example of it working. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. As you noticed, this was a major project. You notice the little traffic that Gary has to deal with and Doug has to deal with. And this project was built under traffic. So as Doug mentioned, the traffic control was unique. The 24/7 operation was very important to this project. And the coordination was very important to this project. And we'll wait for questions till afterwards. But I've got a question on some impacts that you all would have to take into account to address the 24/7. Our next presenter is Doug Fuller, who is Vice President of Operations for Fluor. Doug holds a degree in civil engineering with a background in construction of large, heavy civil projects. Doug serves as proposal manager for Lone Star Infrastructure's successful proposal of the State Highway 130 project, and upon award of the contract, serves as president of the Lone Star Infrastructure Joint Venture and project director responsible for the execution of this project. State Highway 130 project is our first design build project that we're developing as a loop around the east side of Austin. The first four legs basically get us around Austin. We've got a little south leg that we've led as a design bid build project that will connect 130 back to 35. And I'm going to ask Doug to come up here and talk to us a little bit about the design build model and the development of the 130 project. The project is a little bit different, and it also has its uniqueness, and Doug's going to share them with us.
Doug?
Thank you, Amadeo. I think what I will do today is talk a little bit about the scope of the project, SH-130, the status of the project as we stand today. We'll talk a little bit about design build, and in that regard, we'll talk about design build with the backdrop of a conventional project, and then we'll talk about some of the lessons learned. And we'll break that discussion down into the different phases of the project, the procurement phase, the design phase, the pre-construction phase, and also the construction phase. So, looking at the scope of the project, SH-130 is part of the Central Texas Turnpike System. The total project is 91 miles, extending from Georgetown to the north to Seguin in the south. The project was developed in six segments for delivery. And what I'm going to talk about is segments 1 through 4, which is approximately 50 miles of that project, extending from Georgetown down to just south of the airport where the project ties into 183 at Mustang Ridge. If you look at the project and its uniqueness, it was a clear deviation from a traditional approach. The design, in the beginning, it was advanced to a concept stage for environmental clearance of the project. Teams were shortlisted based on qualifications, with the designers participating as part of the team, which was a unique feature here. The scope included design, right-of-way acquisition services, utility coordination, regulatory permitting, construction, long-term maintenance, and an option on developer financing. It was also a best value selection, with 85% of the selection based upon price and 15% based upon a technical evaluation of the proposal. Looking at the status of the project, NTP1 was issued July 16th of 02, which is just a couple of days ago, a few years back. NTP2 was issued in January of 03, and that was significant, the fact that that's when the funds were really available to go forward. And the initial NTP was for mobilization, but the real funds came January of 03. Where we stand today is design is complete, right-of-way acquisition is complete, utility relocations are nearly complete, and we share some of the pain that Mr. Pickock was describing. Construction started in October of 03 and peaked in the 2005-2006 construction season. Through 2005 and 2006, we averaged a construction activity averaged about $1 million a day, and we peaked at about 1,700 craftsmen in the field. Segments 1 and 2 construction is complete. And those segments are under traffic. Segment 3 is substantially complete now, and segment 4 should be complete by the end of the year. If you look at some photos of the project, this is looking from the north at the 35 interchange with 130, as 130 is heading south. There's a shot of a couple of structures over the San Gabriel River. Another shot looking north towards I-35 in segment 1. Shot of the interchange at 79-130. It's a shot of the 45-130 interchange, the confluence of the 45 project on the north with 130. And looking north, or looking up the slide there, you can see the relocation that occurred along FM 685, where it was moved to the outside of the project into a frontage road configuration. Just looking south from the same interchange, looking further south, some more structures. This is the area between Palmer Lane and 290, with the direct connect tying into 290. A similar picture of that interchange. And then looking south into segment 3. Down at the 71 interchange, and then south of the airport, and finally where we're tying into the 183, like I said, south of the airport at Mustang Ridge. So what is design-build? Like I said, we'll talk about what design-build is as a backdrop to a traditional project. If you look at the project elements, whether it be permitting, the preliminary schematic design, the NEPA process, the 404 permit acquisition process, coordination with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, historic properties, FEMA, the design, final schematics, final design, quality assurance and quality control, the pre-construction activities, the right-of-way acquisition, utilities relocation, and also the construction activities, they're all the same on both models. The difference is where those are, those activities, who they report to, and who's responsible for those. So if you take a look at a traditional project, this would be all under the guidance of TxDOT, and they would be guiding every aspect of this. And you would end up with a lump sum contract there at the very end after the design is complete and right-of-way acquisitions occur, and the utilities have hopefully been relocated. If you take a look at how that model changes in a design-build model, as you can see is that a lot of those activities with environmental, NEPA clearance, regulatory permitting, design, right-of-way acquisition, utility relocations, design and construction, QA, and construction all would fall under the design-build firm responsible for those activities. TxDOT may have a GC consultant there and assisting them in the administration of that contract, and you can see is there's significant transfer of risk down to the design-build contractor. If you look at the phases under a traditional approach where you would go through the NEPA process, go through the schematic design, the final design, purchase right-of-way, relocate utilities, and award a construction contract for construction, that changes somewhat under a design-build model. Here the design-build procurement can go concurrent with the NEPA clearance. And after the procurement is complete, you can select the design-build firm and begin the final design or the finalization of the schematics and finalization of the design. But the purchasing of the right-of-way, the relocating of the utilities, and the construction can be overlapped in a phased approach. So it allows you to gain time on the project. If you look at lessons learned, starting with the procurement phase. The industry review meetings we felt were an effective tool for those that have not been involved in one of these procurements. The industry review meeting is a time when you get the opportunity to meet with the owner and to discuss the document to get a better understanding of what the requirements are and so that you can address those in your proposal to the owner. What we saw is it's an ability for us to mitigate risk and the owner to reduce contingent pricing in the proposal. We saw that as being a very effective tool. Designer on the design build team was also positive. And the project received input from multiple designers. On a traditional project, you would have a single designer advancing a design or those design concepts. Here you have a competition for that design. And that segues very well into the next item, which is the ATC process was effective. The ATC process, or alternate technical concept process, was the ability of each team to develop alternate technical concepts to the base technical concept and advance those prior to bid and as part of the competitive process. The owner benefited from that in the fact that they were able to take the best of the ideas and in the fact even apply some of the good ideas from the teams that were not successful to the teams that were successful. In the case of SH-130, some of the ATCs that were brought forward from the other teams accounted in a $75 million reduction in our price prior to start of construction. Some things that we would think that maybe we would want to look forward in the future procurements was control of team actions during procurement. What you can see is if you have 2, 3, 4 different teams running around talking to local authorities, landowners, or whatnot, that could be confusing. And that you want to kind of control that process so everybody's getting the same answer, and that you're not overly burdening the local authorities or the landowners or whatnot. One of the things that we saw as a useful tool was the cross-street matrix, where basically the coordination with a lot of the local municipalities occurred and was agreed upon before we started. Another suggestion would be the limiting of primary participant requirements in the SOQ process. What we found is that when everybody divvied up into teams, that there was pretty good consultants on the teams that were excluded when we were selected. So as opposed to having everybody tie up into teams, you may want to consider in future procurements is to limit that so that you could go forward and then those other consultants would have time, have an opportunity to participate on the successful team's project. And finally, acceptance criteria. Acceptance criteria is really important. It's important to know when you're finished. It affects risks, speed of design, quality review process as a whole. And really, it will challenge the partnering process if you do not have a good, clean understanding of what is acceptable as a product. And this is very important in a design and build environment. If you look at the design phase, open communication is a must. Design has to progress very quickly from concept to working drawings. And you have many professionals involved in the process. And so that is going to generate the need for a lot of open communication, a lot of problem solving. So you have to have a structured process to allow that to go forward. Resolve design criteria, design task protocols earlier. This is important. Again, a lack of criteria will slow you down. You take a large project, you're going to break the design up into smaller pieces. And if you have one team working with a different set of criteria, that the time when that comes together is in the review process, and somebody has to go back and redo things for consistency purposes. So that's important. Co-location. We had several different types of co-location. What we're talking about here is basically being next to each other or in each other's shops. On SH-130, we had an owner design build contractor co-location. We also had the design build contractor and design build team or the design team and consultant community co-located in the same facility. Generated a large office. I think at our peak we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 300, 350 consultants under one roof. But it was very beneficial to go through there and resolve the many questions that had to be resolved very quickly in order to advance the design. Another item is design performed on site. On 130, most of the design was performed on site. Which, like I said, had the effect of moving a lot of people out of their work environments into a new work environment in our office. One of the things we did deserve is that impacts the way many design consultants work, and possibly that may affect their efficiency, and maybe we want to take another look at the amount of work that needs to be done actually in the design-build office versus what can be done in remote offices. And finally, independent design quality assurance. It's a required process to assure design meets requirements, but the roles and the expectations of the independent review must be clear. The effectiveness can be diluted by vague acceptance criteria. This is very important. Design, you know, as the manager of the project, you rely upon the design quality assurance process to make sure that the design you generate meets the owner's requirements. And if we're off target, that means a lot of rework to go back and to fix those problems. But we need to make sure that you have proper alignment between the owner's reviewer and the design QA reviewer and our designers to make sure that process goes very smoothly. Pre-construction phase, allow adequate time for right-of-way acquisition. I think that probably goes without being said. But the acquisition process is designed to protect the owner's rights, of the property owner's rights, and is not designed to expedite the project execution. And it's a good process, but you just have to respect it and allow enough time for it. One of the suggestions we would have would possibly to establish a date of taking for the right-of-way acquisition is NTP of the design-build contract. This, of course, is a legislative issue, but what it would do is, as we noticed, as you have some of the sophisticated property owners, that they begin to divide their property in advance of the acquisition process, which will slow you down quite considerably. This would prevent something like that. It's something we would suggest to be considered. I think another suggestion would be to reconsider the one offer, one counteroffer rule. Part of the process is that you can make one offer and receive one counteroffer, and then you must go into condemnation. I think if you could open that up a little bit, you could probably reduce the amount of condemnations that you would advance. On large projects, consider outstanding committees to expedite condemnation hearings. It would be nice. There's a lot of time expended in trying to coordinate everyone's schedule for a condemnation hearing, and if you had a standing committee that met on a regular basis, you could probably expedite that to a quite a degree. On the utility side, establish umbrella agreements with the utility owners in advance of the design-build contract. Design standards, betterments, acceptable subcontracts, all of that should be addressed. As you get into dealing with the various utility owners, you'll find that some of their internal standards may be higher than the national standard, which governs their work product. And so you have to understand that up front. And the sooner you can get into that and ferret that out, the better off. And also consider compensation to utility companies for the locations based upon performance. It would be a suggestion to go forward. Looking at construction, the definition of the engineer as it pertains to the Blue Book is important, specifically in the areas where the authority to make engineering decisions come into play, and also acceptance of the work. We were able to work through all of these issues, but the Blue Book is important, and it's part of highway construction in the state of Texas. It will remain part of highway construction in the state of Texas, whether it's a design-build project or not, and so you have to make allowances for that. Quality control versus quality assurance, which is OVT. There are three different types of quality review on the product that's produced. It's important to understand the definitions and the roles and responsibilities that each one of those functions play so that it moves forward fully. And finally, constructing with drawings which are less than 100% complete is always a challenge. You have to have a process in place to allow for that. Because you're going to start on a bridge foundation before the bridge superstructure is complete. So you have to allow for that in your process. So thank you for your time. This is all that I had. And
thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. This was our first design-build project that the department has undertaken. It was a project that was developed, procurement started through our Turnpike Authority Division. Phil Russell and the folks that worked for him, as well as the consultants that were helping him, did a great job in going out there and really starting a program from scratch and developing a project. As Doug showed you, the project is on schedule and will be completed. It's a little bit different than the 130 project. There's no traffic out there because we're on a new location, which is a good thing. But we think that this model is a model that we can use and something that will be available to us. We can only do design-build on toll projects at this time, but we're going to be developing some toll projects across the state, and this will be one of the models that will be available to us to use where it fits. Moving along and basically taking the design-build model to the, I guess, the next generation or to the next step or to the next phase, we have continuation of the State Highway 130 project, which we call Segments 5 and 6, which is takes off from the end of the project that Doug just described and continues it on down to Seguin. And this is being developed through a design-build, but it's a design-build concession-type model where we are bringing on board a developer partner through our TTC 35 CDA procurement. We have a developer partner with Centra Zachary, and then they will be developing a project that will not only provide the financing, it will also provide for the design, the buying of the right-of-way, the design, the construction, and also the continued maintenance and operation of the project for a 50-year concession. With us today to discuss that project is Diego Marin, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the State Highway 130 Concession Company. Diego holds an International Master's in Business Administration degree from the Instituto de Empresa from Madrid, Spain, and in Manchester Business School in the UK, and he has a bachelor's degree in business administration with specialization in finance from the University of Zaragoza, also in Spain. Diego served as the project director for the Trans-Texas Corridor TTC 35 project and has substantial experience in the public-private partnerships and strategic consultancy. Please help me welcome Diego Marin with them.
Well, thank you very much, Amadeo. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming this afternoon. Concessions are not very popular these days here in Texas, but my goal today is to try to change this perception of you. And my goal is to show you why we still believe that concessions are the best model and the most efficient and effective way of developing transportation infrastructure. I'm going to be talking to you today about the benefits of the concession model. Firstly, I'll make a comparison with traditional methods. And then I will show you a case study about segments 5 and 6 of SH130, which is the project I'm working on right now. So let's get started. Here in this slide, you can see a comparison between the traditional methods, the design bid build or design build, design build operation maintenance. I mean, these methods have been successfully used in some other projects by different DOTs in the States. For instance, we have the examples that my colleagues have just mentioned, the K3 and the 13124. There's a big difference between these kind of methods and what we call a pure public-private partnership. The PPP is the concession model where a single entity, a privately owned entity, enters into a lease arrangement with an owner to design, build, finance, operate, and maintain an asset for a long period of time. And this asset ultimately goes back to the owner. I think that's the main difference. And if we see the next slide, you can see here a matrix with the different risks per method. In the tool columns of the left, you have the traditional methods, the bid build and design bid build, design build project, where only construction and design are transferred to a private sector. In the concession model, otherwise, we have not only construction design transferred to the public sector, the private sector, but also the finance of the project, the traffic and revenue, the operation, the maintenance, and the upgrade of the project for a long period of time. And this is not the only benefit that concessions bring to the public sector. For instance, I mean, concessions allow to develop projects that otherwise would not have been developed for a long period of time. I have a very clear example here with segments 5 and 6 of SH130. This project had been the plans of TxDOT and other local entities for a number of years, probably since the mid-80s, is the first reference I was able to find of this project. It's only been when TxDOT had decided to move forward the approach of the CDA and of the concession model when this project has become a reality. Also, the concession projects that involve design construction, normally the greenfield projects, normally these projects are faster implemented by a private entity. For instance, our shareholders, Sintra, has developed and has delivered in the last years. For instance, the M4 and 6 project in Ireland. This project had a construction schedule of 36 months, but it was open to traffic in 30 months. Not only that, another project in the center east of Spain, the Madrid-Levante project, is a 120 miles project. It had a very challenging schedule of just 24 months, but it was open to traffic 3 months in advance. It is clear that the concessionaires have a very good incentive to open to traffic and start charging tolls and start trying to recover their investment very quickly. And that's why it is an efficient way to go. Also, you know, probably the overall picture that the concessionaire has helps it to reduce the whole life costs. Normally, the concessionaire is very interested in improving the quality of service because that's the only way it can attract traffic and it can recover the investment. More importantly, these kind of projects not only help to finance an investment, but normally they offer additional revenues and generate additional revenues to the owner. We have the cases here in the States of the Chicago Skyway project, a project that was envisioned just to pay off that the city of Chicago had, which was around $600 million. The first analysis of this project showed that they were going to be able to get around $600 million. Well, at the end, a consortium led by Sintra could put forward a proposal of $1.8 billion. This is not the only example. We have the Indiana Toll Road, another project that was born just because of the need of the governor of Indiana to fund the 10-year transportation plan. Well, again, another consortium also led by Sintra was able to put forward a proposal of $3.8 billion. I mean, this is kind of examples of additional revenues that the concessions could bring. And you're going to see this also in segments 5 and 6. So now let's talk about 5 and 6. I mean, for those of you who are not so familiar with this project, just let you know that SH130 Concession Company entered into an agreement with TxDOT Back in June 2006, after some NEPA clearance, the agreement was signed in March, 22nd of March of 2007. This project includes the construction of a 40-mile toll road linking the southeast of Austin with the east of San Antonio, the city of Seguin. It has two different segments, segment 5 around 12 miles and segment 6 or another 28 miles. And it's going to be a state-of-the-art highway, a real state-of-the-art highway. And this is because it's going to be a free-flow toll road with no toll booths, meaning that nobody's going to have to stop, slow down. They will be able to go and run freely. It will be 100% electronic, so people will be able to pay either with their tech stacks or other transponders from other entities in the state, or they will have their plate photographed by a video system. The timeline of this project includes like 5 years of development. The first 2 years, up to 2009, is going to be the acquisition of right-of-way and the final design. And then construction is expected to start in 2009, and then the project will be open to traffic sometime in 2012. Well, which is unique, at least here in Texas, in this structure, is that the first concession model ever undertaken in the state. In this model, a single entity, in this case, SH-130 Concession Company, which is funded by some shareholders, in this case Sintra and Sacro American Infrastructure, and it's also funded by external debt, so bank loans or bonds or TIFIA funds, this company enters into a facility concession agreement. It's a very complex document which finally protects the rights of both the public sector and the private sector in the transaction. So that's the facility concession agreement that will allow the development of the project for 50 years. Another characteristic here is the additional player we have in the picture. In this case, it's Rabah Kissner. Rabah Kissner will be the independent engineer. And basically, this company is that. It's just an independent external company that makes sure that both public and private sector are complying with the technical requirements and are complying with the facility concession agreement. So this entity, SH-130 Concession Company, will have all the rights and obligations to design, build, finance, operate, and maintain the road for 50 years. Not only that, but the concessionaire will have the responsibility to acquire right-of-way in the name of the state of Texas. Let's keep that clear. I mean, all the right-of-way will be under the name of the state of Texas, and basically the developer is working at risk there to finance all the right-of-way acquisition. The developer is not a construction company, as this is not a construction contract. This is much more than that. I mean, this entity is an investor and it's an operator. So that's why the design and construction of the project are transferred to an expert construction company. We have teamed up with Ferrovia Agroman, one of the largest construction companies in the world, and Sacri Construction Corporation, probably one of the most reputable companies in Texas. These two companies have entered into the design-build construction contract with SH-130 Construction Company. The design-build agreement is a special agreement because it's a lump sum, fixed price, no claims, fixed schedule contract that will allow the project to be developed in time and in budget. Another unique thing of this structure is the way that the project is financed. Some of you will remember that some years ago, some studies were done, and they said that only around $600 million could be raised to finance this project. That was why the project could not move forward at that time. Well, with the concession model, there's a single entity that can raise $1.3 billion to finance the project. It's committed to raise that money. And the way it's going to do it is first through some equity that shareholders are going to bring, around $331 million, and then the rest will be raised and will be leveraged in the financial markets. Well, either with bonds, bank loans, or TIFIA funds. This will finance all the construction and investment costs, and also will finance the right-of-way acquisition, together with an additional revenue for TxDOT. And that's what I'm going to explain in the next slide. I mean, the beauty of this concept is that it not only allows to finance an investment, it also provides for additional revenue to the owner. And in this case, TxDOT decided to have a mixed solution with an upfront payment of $25 million and then a revenue share based on a system of bonds that could bring at the end of the concession around $1.74 billion. Well, basically, the bottom line is that the concession has allowed this project to be developed much faster, much earlier than anybody could think of. The whole project is going to be financed just with private equity, and no public dollars are going to be involved in the transaction. TxDOT may get at the end more than $1.7 billion in additional revenue. And after 50 years, they will have a very well taken care road. They will have for 50 years a world-class operator operating the road, and they will have a complete debt-free asset of worth more than $1.3 billion. So at the end of the day, I mean, I go back to my initial statement. I think the concession models are really the best solution possible to keep Texas moving. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diego. As you noticed, the CDA concession model really is more of a financial contract that, in essence, will include and has the elements of constructing, but also includes the financing, maintaining, and operating the project for a period of time. So now what I'd like to do is to see if you all would have any questions, and I hope you do, because otherwise I'm going to have to come up with some. So I've been jotting some notes just in case we don't have any volunteers with questions. So if anyone has any questions, please.
I think when the owners,
and I guess it would be good if you could just come up to the mic. That way, everyone get a chance to hear you, and we make sure that we hear the question. Thank you.
On the 130 concession model, what factors influence the level of concession payment to TxDOT over the concession period?
Well, in case of 5 and 6, the concession payment is based on two facts. First of all, as I said, there's an upfront concession payment that will depend on the final posted speed limit in the highway. Initially, it's going to be $25 million that will be paid to TxDOT. And then the rest of the revenue share will be in terms of percentage of the total revenues that the concessionaire is going to collect the next 50 years. There's a system of bands based on the initial and approved and agreed traffic and revenue study, and based on those bands, depending on where the revenues are, the state will get something between 5% of the revenues up to more than 50% of the revenues. Basically, the idea is that each project is different, and always the owners need to make a decision, a trade-off between what do you want. Do you want to have a short-term solution and get more upfront fees, or I want to share some kind of the risk and obviously more benefit in the future and have a revenue share. And this is something that DOTs or on the states, sorry, on the states are designing right now.
Let me add a few other things. Of course, the facility agreement or the contract has a series of business terms. For example, the toll rate, the toll escalation rate, the risk transfer elements. For example, how are you handling construction risk? How are you handling environmental risk? How are you handling the type of tolling system that you spec out? So your contract and the specifications that are in the contract will dictate what the value of the concession is. The developer is projecting the traffic. He is taking that traffic versus the cost of the project to build, the cost of the right-of-way to purchase and procure, and then, of course, the maintenance and operation. And then those are costs that go against what traffic he projects will happen. He applies the contract specifications to that, and then basically that will determine what comes forward in the upfront payment. And then, of course, what we had set up on the project is we set up this revenue banding system that said that if once traffic reaches certain levels in any 1 year, then we start sharing in the revenue. So all the specs determine the amount of the upfront payment as well as the additional annual payments. Next question.
I hadn't seen a lot of highways in the great state of Texas, but I've seen a few. And my question to Doug is, rarely can you say that a highway has added to the quality and the aesthetic beauty in a community. I-10 is one of the finest looking highways that I've seen in my lifetime, which is 57 years, in the state of Texas. How did you make that happen, Doug?
Jody, you said that just like I asked you to. We didn't have anything to do with that. You have to give total credit for that to TxDOT. That's their design, and I agree with you. It is a beautiful highway. It's a pleasure to drive on it, particularly Sunday morning when there's nobody around.
And I think I will add to that. And Gary, I may ask you to expand on what I say, but Gary's people worked with the consultants and worked with the community in Houston and to come up with the kind of the standards or the design parameters that would make that facility so that when we finish that facility, it doesn't look just like, you know, concrete and pavement, but it looks like something that it'd be a pleasure to drive on. So Gary and his folks working with the Houston folks made that happen. Doug just implemented it for us. But he implemented it very well because it looks great. Gary, anything to add to that? Thank you, sir. Next question.
In the event of where the contractor is taking on the risk of acquiring right-of-way, how was that risk in acquisition managed? How was those factors taken into consideration?
What's the question for?
The risk with the right-of-way acquisition risk is done, it included both in the design-build contractor in 1-4 and also in the concession. I'm going to let Doug kind of talk about your portion of the risk. I think you cover just mostly the acquisition, the cost of acquisition, and not the property acquisition. And then Diego will follow up with a different model where the developer is taking the risk of the right of the road.
That's correct. On segments 1-4, the consultants associated with establishing the right-of-way maps, the determining the taking, and also the appraisals and making the offers, all work for Lone Star. But when the actual check was written for the property acquisition, it was written through TxDOT. From our standpoint, we had the risk associated with the time, the delay, or the timing of the acquisition, but not in the actual cost of the acquisition.
Diego, you want to cover a little bit on the
In our case, it's similar to LSI's risk in 1-4, but the only difference is that we also take the risk of financing the railway acquisition. So if the cost goes up, it's also our risk. So we include in our models is our estimate of what the railway acquisition was going to cost, and we'll bear the risk of it's higher in the end.
Thank you. I will say, as Diego mentioned, the developer is responsible for moving forward with the acquisition. At some point, should that acquisition have to go through the eminent domain process, then those are turned over to TxDOT and through the Attorney General's office, and they're required following the eminent domain process that we follow on all our projects. Next question.
This is a question mostly for Doug Fuller, but if Diego wants to chime in on the independent engineer. I think for those of us who are new in this and trying to get projects off the ground, the compression of that time period is probably one of the most crucial things that can happen. Can you kind of go through how you maybe rearranged some of the duties of the GEC and the design build team to where you got all of that to occur a little faster than if it would just a design and bid? And, you know, and I assume that the independent engineer, you know, basically filled that GEC role in the concession. But if there's a clarification there, I'd like to hear that also.
All right, I'll start off. The terminology is a little bit different because on SH-130 we had a GEC. We also had an independent engineer. We had two independent engineers, one associated with the design reviews and the other one associated with the construction reviews. And again, and part of the effort to bring those functions together, we've talked about a little bit in the slide, and it's you have to organize yourself to have good, clear, quick communication lines of communications, and also the ability to push decision making down to the levels that needs to be. We also instituted a partnering process where we would keep tabs on issues that resided in lower levels. for too long, and then we'd reach down from time to time and pull those up. But we did that in concert with the GEC and also with TxDOT. So very much SH-130 was a partner process, and we could not abate it as fast as we did or quick as we did without the help of HDRs, the GEC, TxDOT in their guidance, and also our project team as a whole. So a lot of it has to do with that.
Yeah, in the case of 5 and 6, I mean, the role of the independent engineer is basically to make sure that both parties, especially the developer, is complying with technical requirements that are specified in the contract. The independent engineer will work as an auditor. It will review the design and the construction. I will give recommendations to both developer and TxDOT. But TxDOT will always have the ultimate decision if there is a need for an approval, for instance. Quality assurance and quality control in this case are done directly by us and normally by our design construction joint venture, but will not be taken care of by the pay engineer.
Okay. Let me follow up a little bit, and I'll ask you a question a little bit different. But both the design build model as far as the, and also the concession model, the developer or the design build contractor has a quality control, quality assurance engineering firm that's working and the design build is really independent of them in reviewing the work for them. They're responsible for that. Can you all comment on that relationship with respect to your design builder and your quality assurance, quality control?
Well, in our case, the quality assurance and quality control are done by us, basically by our design build joint venture, which basically is working for us and in developing the project. And then the independent engineer is the one that makes sure that this quality is happening and make sure that we are complying with our own quality plans. So it has more an auditor role than probably in the design build method.
Right.
Well, you know, with us, the independent engineer reports, and we'll take a look, we'll talk just about the design independent design review. And the quality control occurs within design organization itself, and the role of the independent engineer is to review the design for compliance with the contract requirements. And so he would report dually, reported dually not only to me on the project, but also to TxDOT to make sure that the public is being served there, to make sure that the drawings that we produce do meet the design standards and also contract requirements.
Right. Then the independent engineer really on both cases then does all the additional owner verification testing that's required because the projects you're usually tied to state funding or federal funding. Next question.
I'd like to ask all three presenters if there are any lessons that can be gleaned in terms of cooperation from the utility companies as to whether their contractors do utility relocation or if at any point you're allowed to take over the relocation of utilities if they're dragging or not responding, or have you been allowed to put bonuses into your arrangements with the utility companies to get them to move ahead because they, in many cases, have a different agenda from the TxDOT agenda. And our experience over the years is sometimes their enthusiasm is limited. And I'm wondering what measures or devices you may have found to get that accelerated and commitment to achieve the kind of results you're achieving.
These guys are out in the woods. They basically don't have the same problem that we have on the Katy Freeway and in urban construction where you're trying to do this. We're still sort of speechless. AT&T has their own contractors. I don't think they would let us touch their stuff if we wanted to. On the other hand, there's a great trend. David Castile has a project over in San Antonio where and we're the contractor on it. We're just getting started, but we're doing gas and of course the normal stuff, sanitary, storm and water. A lot of these, and maybe Gary or one of his people could speak to this a lot better than me since they're the ones that deal with them. It's a problem for us, whether we're doing it whether we're doing the work or whether the utilities company's doing the work. Because if we're doing it, generally it's a specialty subcontractor, and he has to deal with the same utility company that would be doing the work if they were doing it themselves. So it's, I hate to give you a fuzzy answer, it's just a big problem either way you do it. And I'd welcome Gary or Bob or anybody else to comment. Bob, what do you think? Okay. The jury's still out. We like to have control of the work, all the work we can get control of. On the other hand, these utility companies have their own contractors that they have confidence in. A lot of times there's some proprietary stuff they don't want to really put out on the street. So I think it's something that both TxDOT, and I don't mean to be speaking for them, but I think we're all kind of working our way through improving the deal, but I don't know what the real answer is. Maybe Amadeo does.
We did both ways. We dealt with 50 utility companies. I think we had something in the neighborhood of just over 600 relocations. Part of them we did as a contractor managed, where we did the work ourselves, or we hired a subcontractor to do it with a specialty in that area. But all too often you run into the utilities who want to do it with their specialty contract or their subcontractors, which makes it difficult. Timing is tough at best. One of the suggestions that we had made is that possibly some of the, you know, some of the compensation might be performance based from that regard, because there has to, because for sure, a utility company would just assume you move the road as opposed to move their utilities, and all too often. So it is a challenge, and the sooner you get into it and start working your way through the problem areas, the sooner you can get a solution. We still fight utilities now.
Well, in our case, we haven't even started yet the utility relocation, but I'm sure our design construction company will really appreciate any lessons learned in the other projects. I think the early contact with the utilities is critical, because in our case, we don't have the benefit of time, so we really have to early contact them and try to work with them, collaborate with them in a way that we can move forward.
We warmed them up for you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. I have a question about the State 130 project in terms of the projections for growth of usage for this. You're designing and building it for a certain volume of traffic, and Doug has had the experience of rebuilding the Katy Freeway, which was designed in the 50s or 60s to carry 100,000 cars a day, and it was carrying 300,000 cars a day 5-10 years ago. What sort of projections did you make in terms of volume of traffic for this new highway? And then secondly, what are the financial assurances that the private sector has to put up to bond or guarantee that this work gets done?
Let me start. I guess, Diego, can you cover?
Yeah, I can cover the guarantees and all that.
Yes.
Well, basically, when we signed the agreement with TxDOT, we had to put several guarantees. First of all, we put a $100 million guarantee to cover our ability to reach close of finance, so we have the obligation to reach close of finance. Also, we put a guarantee to cover the $25 million of the concession payment, and another additional guarantee to cover basically the sales tax that could be eventually paid in this project. Basically, the biggest guarantee we have here is besides that, is the $300 million equity that that our company, that the shareholders are going to inject in the project, that if the project goes wrong, they will lose this amount of money, with an addition of losing all the debt and all the credibility in the market. So, those are the kind of guarantees that we're putting on the table when we develop a project.
On segments 1 through 4, we have the normal bonding requirements. We also have parent company guarantees are in place from the member firms to guarantee the performance. As far as projecting the traffic loads, I think that the traffic study, the TNR studies that were used to determine what the future revenues would be, were used as the basis of determining what the traffic counts would be, and that found its way in the form of criteria required for the design of the project.
Under the 130, 1 through 4, the design build model, a lot of the determination in the capacity that's built is what's being built, and then once that project is complete, There are some allowances for maintenance periods that we can keep and move forward with and let LSI continue to maintain it. But any future added capacity would then be done through the department. Now, through our studies that we did, we determined how much right-of-way we would need for added capacity. For example, the 130 project has a median of about 130 feet. Is Phil here? He not here.
Yeah.
105? 105 feet that would allow for added capacity both to the inside as well as to the outside. There's some additional room for added capacity. Now, when we look at the concession model, that project and the specifications for a concession-type project are more of performance-based. So it is up to the developer to determine how many lanes he needs depending on the traffic that will be using that project over the 50-year time. They're also responsible for, as that traffic volume increases and the level of service, and in this case, I believe we were using speed, when speeds drop below a certain amount, he has to take necessary action to address that congestion either by adding capacity or making improvements of traffic so that the speed goes back up. But they would be responsible for the added capacity through the 50-year life of the concession.
I cover that?
Yep. Next question. I want to thank our speakers. I think they did a great job. Not that I'm going to let you all go because I want to talk a little bit more, but what we tried to present to you today is the different models that can be used to develop these major projects. Depending on the type of project, each one has its benefits, its pluses and minuses, and this will allow us flexibility to develop a project using the best model possible. So again, I thank our speakers. Now what I'd like to do is, real quick, as a follow-up, because Mr. Barron's talked this morning, is talk a little bit about Senate Bill 792, which was the major transportation bill that was passed this last legislative session. What I kind of will cover today is basically we'll just kind of go over a little bit on 792, what 792 does and what changes we'll have to make the way we run our business when it talks to our public-private partnerships and the development of toll projects in the different parts of the state. We'll look at one of the things that was added by 792 was the requirement of putting place and developing a market valuation, and we're going to kind of go over kind of how that's going to be done, when it's going to be done, and how we're going to initiate that. And then basically part of that 792 requires us to identify, and the way to get this thing started is we need to identify some toll projects across the state, and we've been working with our districts and our MPOs, and we've identified the potential toll projects across the state that would be subject to this market valuation. We've initiated the process by taking them forward to our commission, and on the 14th of June, I presented to the commission basically this same presentation, so it's not brand new, that would initiate some of the requirements of Senate Bill 792, which will kind of show us how we're going to develop projects. We identified 87 projects across the state that have good potential toll elements, and they'll be developed, and of course, following what's outlined in Senate Bill 792. You know, our current transportation system is aging. I had our people give me the kind of what the average age of our system, and it came back that it was something like an average of about 46 years old. So our average life of a highway system is 46 years old. We usually design it for 20 years, so we must be doing a pretty good job if it's 46 and it's still there. But it's aging. We've got congestion all over the place. Our payment scores show that we're going to have to make some decisions because we've been losing ground in our payment scores, and we're going to have to do something in the years to come to address to make sure that payments don't deteriorate to the point that we can no longer just use preservation and minor rehab and will require full reconstruction. And so we're going to have a balance between our mobility funds and our money. We also expect our population to grow double within the next 25 years. At noon, Chairman Williamson talked about that every night when he goes to bed, the next morning there's 1,000 to 1,500 people moved into Texas. Well, that population increase is going to bring more people, more cars, more users of the system, and additional congestion. So we're going to need to rely on some strategies that will help us increase the competitive pressures and demand, and also consumer do some consumer-driven demand decisions, empower our local officials and regional leaders to help us solve the transportation problem, and basically use all the financial tools that the legislature has given us to address and build the infrastructure that we need. Senate Bill 792, as I mentioned, was a major transportation bill that was passed this last legislative session, and there are five major components to Senate Bill 792. First thing it did, it placed a two-year moratorium on the CDA process. But it has certain exceptions, and I'll go over those in a little bit. It changed the expiration date to the sunset of the CDA program from 2011 to 2009, with some exceptions also. It addressed some of the concerns that the public had with the CDA process that dealt with the transparency, that was not transparent enough, that things were happening and they didn't know, the public didn't know exactly what was happening. It also provided and gives tolling entities primacy on some toll projects that are within the jurisdiction. And it establishes a procedure, and this is one of the most important things, it establishes a procedure for the development of future toll projects as we develop those projects across the state. I'd like to talk about each one of those real quick. The moratorium. The moratorium will last until September 1st of 2009. In the meantime, but it did, like I said, it did have some exceptions. The projects that I have here on this list were exempted from the moratorium and can continue. For all other projects that are not on this list, basically at during this time, we cannot enter into a CDA, or a CDA cannot contain any provision that permits the private participant to operate the toll project, to collect the revenues from the toll project, regardless of whether the private participant operates or collects revenue on the toll project. So they cannot, in essence, collect the tolls or get money from the tolls. Under 792, the legislature also moved up the expiration date for CDAs by 2 years. However, they do allow for projects that are exempted under the moratorium to be developed as long as the contract is signed by 2011. Our old expiration date was in 2011, so the projects that were on the list and that we're working on that were exempted, we have till 2011 to develop those projects. I hope we're not that slow and those projects get developed much faster. In addition, they allow projects where a private entity is not granted the right to finance the project to continue and also go past all the way to 2011. This allows us to continue to use a design-build model and the design-bid-build model that we're tolling all the way to 2011. The bill also created a study commission that will review the CDA program during the interim and submit a report back to the legislature. And, of course, we hope that through this and also through the sunset process that the department will be going through, the legislature will come back next session, in essence, reinstate our CDA program as an essential tool to developing transportation projects. The legislature also responded to a lot of concerns about CDAs, that the process was not transparent enough, by enacting some reforms that required newspaper notices and public hearings on all toll projects. Also, documents and contracts must be put on the internet in a timely manner. These reforms apply to all tolling entities, not just to TxDOT, but all the other tolling entities. In addition, the State Auditor's Office and the LBB and the Attorney General will each play a role in reviewing the approval of our CDA, our CDAs under the bill. There's also a rider in the appropriations bill that bans the use of appropriated funds for toll road traffic and revenue studies unless the controller is the entity that is conducting or managing these studies. Primacy. Primacy was the bill established that local toll project entities such as the RMAs in the different areas of the state, the NTTA in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the county toll authorities like HECTRA and the other county, will have primacy and be responsible for developing toll projects within their jurisdiction. They also get access to the state highway system, and but they're required to pay for what the price of what the right-of-way originally cost. So they will be able to go out there in Houston that if HECTRA wants to develop a toll project on 288, they can come and use our state right-of-way on 288. They'll just have to pay for the right-of-way. They'll also have to enter into an agreement where we will outline all of the requirements for HECTRA to be able to operate a toll road within that agreement. The Houston Area Toll Road Authority were given specific projects under the bill that they can develop without any question, basically that they'll develop them under their model. This included the Beltway 8 East, which is the final segment of Beltway 8, Hardy Road Connector, State Highway 288, the 290 or Hempstead Highway, and some off-system roads on Fairmont Parkway, South Post Oak Road, West Park Toll Road, Phase 2, and Fort Bend Parkway. And some of these are also in the Fort Bend County Toll Roads. NTTA in the Dallas-Fort Worth area was also given several projects that they would develop under 792. This included that Lake Louisville Bridge, the eastern extension of the President George Bush, and also the Southwest Parkway, State Highway 121 in Tarrant County. All the other projects that that were identified that we move forward in developing as toll projects within those areas will have to go through what we call this market valuation process. This is probably the most complex part of the bill, in the process that must be followed for future toll projects where the local tolling entity is present. Where we do not have a local tolling entity, then we would just continue to work closely with the local county officials and city officials to develop the project, and TxDOT would be the toll road developer for those. There are five major steps in this market valuation process as set out in 792. First, either the local tolling entity or TxDOT can identify the project that should be developed as toll projects. And this is the purpose for the meeting that we had on the 14th, where we identified projects and presented them to our commission for them to approve us to move forward. We provided them a list of projects. As I mentioned, there are 87 projects. I'll go over the number of projects by district and the dollar amount in a little bit. But that information is also available on our website, where we have this presentation as well as the attachments that went with that. Secondly, the second thing that needs to happen is we sit down with the local tolling entity and the department, and we must agree to the terms and conditions that will govern the development of the project. And we'll also have to agree on who will perform this market valuation. The next step after that is then that we will, each entity must negotiate the next thing after that is basically the market valuator will go out there and evaluate the project, bring it back to the department and the local tolling entity, which at that point the local tolling entity will have the right of first choice to develop that project. Should they choose to develop it, then there's some timelines that they have to move forward with development of the project. They would have to start the project within the first 6 months, and then start the environmental on that project within the first 6 months. And then they would also have to enter into the construction contracts within 2 years after the environmental has been cleared. But also very important is the local tolling entity must also agree to commit to providing the value of that project into a subaccount for the development of other projects within that region of where the project is located. As I mentioned, the local tolling entity and TxDOT agree to the value of the project before market valuation is performed, and the tolling entity, we agree to the value, then we could waive it and move on to the next step. The market valuation will be based on terms and conditions that are mutually agreed by both TxDOT and the local tolling entity. We're going to look at initial toll rates. I agree on the initial toll rates. We're going to agree on the toll escalation process and mechanism, methodology. The traffic and revenue numbers. We're going to agree on how much traffic and projected traffic, the scope of the project, what is it that we're going to build. We're looking at estimated cost and, of course, any other cost that we could look at with respect to business terms, with respect to standards, both for maintaining, operating, and constructing that will have an impact on the project. What we're trying to do is we're trying to determine the value of the project based on the revenue that this project would bring minus the cost that this project would have, and the difference would be the market value of the project. If during the time that we're negotiating the terms and conditions, the parties cannot agree, then that project in essence is set aside and does not move forward. So once we agree on these terms, then of course the evaluator will go out there and prepare that market valuation. The entities will then, after it's done, they bring it back to the two entities, and we will agree, or we can question or provide comments on the market valuation. There's a 90-day period there's a 90-day period out there so that we can, in essence, provide comments or continue to negotiate to agree to that market valuation. If during that 90-day period we cannot agree, then that valuation that was based and developed in accordance to the original process becomes final. Okay, one of the things that we're doing is one of the, that addresses the issue of transparency is as we do this market valuations is as we sit down with the local tolling entities, we're going to record those negotiations so that we have a clear record of what was agreed upon with respect to the business terms, conditions, so that there's no question after the fact that, no, I didn't agree to that and I don't agree to the value because we didn't agree to that. All of that we want to make sure. This will ensure transparency. We want to make sure that the acceptance of those business terms are done in a public meeting so that the public knows. And the public would be invited to attend these negotiations. Again, we're trying to address the transparency issues. As I mentioned, once the valuation is complete, the tolling entity in the department will have 90 days to review it. Then if after the 90 days we don't agree, then it becomes final. And then at that point, the local tolling entity would have 6 months to exercise its right of first option to move forward with the project. And as I mentioned earlier, if they do take that option, then they have 6 months to start on the environmental process if it has not been done. And then 2 years after the environmental process is complete, they need to enter into the construction contract and also need to commit to providing the value of the project as determined by that market valuation into this sub-account. If the local tolling entity decides that they do not want to exercise their right to develop the project, then the ball switches over to the department and we have 2 months to decide that we want to take the option to move forward. And I guess we have 2 years after the environmental is complete to enter into the construction contract and move that project forward. We also have to agree to commit the market valuation to that project. So that's very important that both of us are doing it exactly the same way. So to start the process, we had to identify what candidate projects were out there. We went out there and worked with our district offices and our MPOs, look at their long-range plans, and we identified what projects would be subject to this market valuation. And we kind of put together what I call as a timeline of how we're going to do that. We immediately have notified the legislature and the MPOs that we've identified these projects and we're moving forward with the requirements of 792. We're going to be meeting with the local tolling entities to develop the terms and conditions. We think that will take us about 60 days. We're going to have different teams doing this, and we will have a person that will be denoted or be the designated negotiator for TxDOT for each individual project or a group of projects within the same area. We will get those market valuations conducted, and then, of course, then that will bring us to the 90-day review period, and then, of course, then the tolling entity will get right first choice. And then, of course, if they don't take it, as I mentioned, then we will do it. So we've initiated the process and identified a total of 87 projects. I think there are 88 because we came back and added another one in the July meeting. And the projects are scattered across the state. Some of these projects, as I mentioned, are not in the districts where a local tolling entity, and for those projects, we will continue to work with the county officials to move forward. But these projects total about $56 billion worth of construction that could be developed. This is a big challenge that we have. As I mentioned, if the list of the detailed projects is on our website. I don't have it in my presentation because I couldn't put it. We put it on a map to just identify kind of where they're at. It was passed also in our minute order. So these projects will help us and move us forward to identify and get these projects built over the next 2 years, which is the time that we have to move forward with the CDA process. So I guess what I've got to say is 792 put a process in place. We've initiated the process, and we look forward to working with RMAs, with NTTA in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and with the county toll road authorities across the state to move forward and get these projects built. And with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions. Any questions? Well, with that, I thank you all for attending this session, and I hope you've enjoyed the... Hope you've enjoyed the forum so far, and I think we have a lot more sessions that are equally as important and as informative, and hopefully this will only will better last year's and set a standard for next year. Thank you all very much.